It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about some of the coolest science headlines from a new way to tackle invasive species to a last resort way to save the planet Earth.
First, we're looking at another angle of Governor Scott Walker's proposed budget. The budget includes reforms and changes to programs and policies that Wisconsinites with disabilities rely on to live and work in their communities. Advocates around the state are looking closely at these reforms to see how they could affect people with disabilities. Here to break down some of the changes for us is Beth Swedeen. She's the executive director for the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. Beth, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's look at some of the changes that would impact people with disabilities. How would Governor Walker's budget change the program known as IRIS? It stands for Include, Respect, I Self-Direct.
Mm-hmm. So overall in Wisconsin, there's a system of long-term care supports known as family care. And then within that, there's the, or separate from that, rather, is a program called IRIS that also provides long-term care supports. But instead of using a managed care model with a care provider and a team, the family of the individual or the individual themselves self-directs their own services. So they choose the kinds of supports that make the most sense for them, and then they hire their own care workers. And the budget actually calls for the elimination of the IRIS program, and instead people would self-direct within family care if they chose to do that.
Can you give us a sense of how this program is being used by people today? What sorts of things do families and people do choose to do with IRIS?
Sure. So most people think of Medicaid as a program that provides health insurance. But for people who have disabilities and for older adults who are frail elders, there's a set of supports called long-term supports in Family Care and IRIS, or they are the Family Care and IRIS programs, that provide some supports that you wouldn't typically think of as health insurance. So things like personal care is to come into your home and help you get up in the morning, get dressed, get bathed. If you need that support, help with meals, with cleaning, maybe provide transportation. And so you can probably imagine that for people with disabilities, this is really a lifeline for them to participate in their communities, to hold a job, to contribute in any way, because those supports are so critical to their daily success.
Are there services that people can get with IRIS that they are not able to access through other means?
The service packages are pretty much the same with IRIS and family care. The difference in IRIS that's so distinct for so many people, or the biggest difference, is that once you are assessed through a tool that looks at the kind of supports you need, you are able to take that budget of money and hire your own caregivers and determine what makes the most sense for you. So as an example, we know folks who really want to work in the community, and they've hired their own job coach at maybe $11 or $12 an hour, and they don't then pay for an agency to do that for more like $25 or $30 an hour. So they're choosing the people themselves to provide the supports. They can hire a neighbor to provide transportation, which, as you can probably imagine, in a rural area, is so much more reliable than trying to find a taxi service or a public transportation that doesn't even exist. So there are lots of flexible ways to use IRIS, and the person gets to choose the people themselves. So they don't have to use a care organization or a provider network. They can actually hire anybody they want. And there's a flexibility in that, especially in rural areas, that's really critical for people to be able to maintain their independence and stay in their own homes. And both of the long-term care programs are really designed to get people out of institutional care, which costs so much, nursing homes and institutions, and let them live at home, which is what most people say they really want to do.
So in broad strokes, how would this elimination of IRIS affect people with disabilities?
Well, I know that our phones are ringing off the hook, and lots of people are near tears or in tears asking us what it means for them. For a lot of people, they feel that it means enrolling in a managed care organization where a care team and a nurse might make the decisions that they've been making for themselves. You know, some people are concerned that if they're in an area without, service provider networks, that they won't be able to find providers that can provide the support. And when you're looking at personal care and other long-term care supports, we're talking about things that are very intimate and very personal, like taking a bath. And a lot of people are saying, I don't want somebody assigned by an agency to come in. I want somebody who's trusted, who I've chosen myself.
Another proposal from Governor Walker's budget is to change how the Children's Long-Term Support Program works. How does the governor want to change that program?
Well, we're still analyzing that, but just like the Family Care and IRIS programs in Wisconsin, the Children's Long-Term Care Program has a really rich history of being built on the individual needs and the input of families of children with the most significant disabilities. So both Family Care and IRIS and the Children's Program were programs that really came out of the collective thinking of people who live with disability, they're in communities, and what makes sense for them. So the Family Support Program has been very flexible in allowing families who have kids with significant disabilities to purchase items that might not be typical to a family that doesn't have someone with a disability, things like that might seem like they are luxuries or not necessary, but for a family of a child with a disability is critical to health and safety. And I'll give you an example. Some people have chosen to have fencing put around their yard, and it's because they have a child who's a runner and can get lost or will just take off and has figured out how to get outside even with door locks. And so it might look like, well, is that a wise use of money? But for that family, keeping their child safe requires fencing. So it might build a ramp to get into a house or enlarge a doorway. It might provide support so a family can learn a complicated care technique so that they can do it themselves instead of hiring a nurse. So there's lots of flexibility in the children's program right now that a lot of families are very concerned about if it goes to a more county-based waiver model. This was a program that has almost 30 years now of history of being built on what families in communities say is important to them.
Now, Governor Walker has put a big emphasis on workforce readiness and workforce training. What has he done to help increase worker training and education options for the disabled here in Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. So in last year, the governor declared that year is the year of the better bottom line, and he based it on some work that's being done by the governor's associations across the country and really had some wonderful innovative ideas about getting more people with disabilities into the workforce. And we know that Governor Walker is a big supporter of people with disabilities being able to contribute and work in the community. So last year, for instance, he signed into law a bill that would expand division of voc rehab funds so that more supports on the job were available to people with disabilities. And we were really hoping to have some of those entities in the new budget. It is looking like there's a series of fast-forward grants that would be eligible for school districts that schools that are training students with disabilities might be able to apply for. But we were really disappointed to see that there wasn't a lot of things in the budget to continue on that success of getting more people with disabilities into work.
Now, at this point, do you have any plans to ask Governor Walker to reconsider what he's included in the budget to make changes?
Oh, sure. Disability advocates have worked very closely with the governor's office and with the legislature, and this is an issue that really goes across party lines because the disability community is so diverse and it comes from all walks of life. And we have had conversations in the past that have been very productive, and we will continue to work both with the governor's office and the legislature to really make the compelling message that people with disabilities want to be part of their communities, they want to stay in their own homes, they want to work and contribute, and that an investment in these public programs really has a long-term return on investment payoff because people save money by not being in institutional or nursing home care, and they get to lead the lives they want, and they're giving back and becoming taxpayers.
Now, overall, what is your sense of what this budget could mean for people with disabilities in Wisconsin?
Well, we're really concerned about the long-term care changes just in that this Wisconsin system of both managed care and self-direction is really one of the leading models in the entire country. And I know in my national networks, a lot of people ask me about how we've done things in Wisconsin because it is so built on the unique input of people with disabilities and their families coming from all different parts of the state. And as you know, we have very, very rural areas, we have very, very urban areas, and we have a system of managed care that's really been very responsive to geographic things, you know, geographic circumstances and relationships, which are so important. So this idea of having a big statewide entity possibly coming in to become the one kind of one big provider for family care is concerning to us, and we really think that dismantling self-direction through the IRIS program is another step backwards as far as not allowing people to make the choices that make the most sense for them.
Beth, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Beth Swedien, Executive Director for the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. She was with us to talk about concerns that some disability advocates have about the governor's budget. We're digging into some headlines from the science world with our regular science guest, Gemma Tarlak. From dining on invasive species to stopping the end of the world with a nuclear blast, we've got some interesting stories to talk about today.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She's with us every month to talk about some of the latest cool science news. Gemma, welcome back.
Hey, always good to be with you guys.
So a tasty story maybe to start with, best headline, if you can't beat them, eat them. So invasive species, a new radical approach.
And a delicious one, apparently. So just a word to the listeners, if you are eating a late lunch, you might want to put the fork down, because apparently the latest thing are researchers studying invasive species by day and then eating them by night. The whole idea is not, you know, love your enemy, but actually eat your enemy. And yeah, we talked to a couple different doctoral students who came up with these recipes to basically eat their research subjects.
Apparently this has really taken off. There are recipes that you include, or at least profiles of them, pictures in the magazine, including deep-fried invasive earthworms. How does this stuff actually taste?
You know, I am quite devastated that I was never offered a taste, so I cannot comment. But apparently, you know, people ate them and lived to tell about it. One of the researchers, I love it, he says to cut the mud flour, to cut the mud flavor, he feeds the animals cornmeal before sauteing them.
That's like a Chinese Chinese mystery snail fettuccine is the recipe, right?
Yes. And, you know, you thought mystery meat was bad at the cafeteria. Well, here's a mystery snail for you. And you know, we didn't have room to run the recipes, but if you go to invasivore.org, you can apparently get all the delicious recipes, as well as a lot of other ideas on how to, you know, if you can't beat them, eat them when it comes to invasive species.
So are people actually doing this, or is this just kind of a lark?
No, I mean, apparently it started as a lark with, you know, researchers kind of up in the UP without anything to do and thinking, well, we got all these, you know, invasive species. How do they taste? But apparently it's really taken off. And that's not too surprising given, you know, the locavore movements and increasing interest in things like eating insects. And, you know, it does make sense on just a very logical level. It makes absolute sense. But on the other hand, I'm not going to be tucking into any mud-flavored snails anytime soon. That's
just
me.
If this is a real problem, a lot of these invasives, if we can find some use for them, culinary or otherwise, it could give us an incentive to put a dent into some of these species that are causing so much trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know there are some places like, you know, the dreaded Asian carp. Mm-hmm. I know there are some places that are actually serving them up, or other fish that have made it into various waterways. And they're trying to get people to say, hey, you know, try this out. So it's definitely a trend. How far the trend will go, you know, if it will extend to delicious invasive earthworms, I don't know. But it's certainly a novel approach. And what I like about it is that it's kind of neutral. You know, you're not introducing another invasive species to fight the first invasive species, which has happened in the past. And it's just, you know, it's kind of a positive story out of something really destructive and kind of gross.
Well, our next story is kind of the stuff of Hollywood blockbusters, but there is a physicist living in New Mexico who spent decades studying a last resort way to save planet Earth by stopping killer asteroids. So how could we stop an asteroid that's headed straight for the planet?
Well, you know, as Bruce Willis and Aerosmith taught us, we could just kind of ram a spacecraft into an asteroid, but the physicist, John Remo, has a much more elegant solution. He wants us to launch nuclear weapons into space and then to detonate the weapons at a certain distance from the incoming asteroid. Doesn't want to destroy the asteroid, does not want to break it into a bunch of little asteroids that would all be dangerous on their own, but the idea is you detonate the nuclear weapons just close enough and just in the right spot with just enough force to nudge the asteroid out of our way. And then it could go on its merry way and, you know, destroy some other planet. But for us, we would save the planet with, you know, he says we've got the technology. We just haven't had the will to develop a cohesive policy to do it.
So how far out would we have to catch that asteroid, detect it, to be able to intercept it and nudge it out of the way with a subtle little, you know, nuclear blast?
Well, actually, he thinks, you know, we could rally, and if we saw, say, 2 weeks out or 3 weeks out, that we have the technology to rally and get it done. But there are a lot of obstacles in the way right now, everything from just people not working together on this project as a whole, but also just political issues. You know, there are a lot of international treaties that say, hey, you can't put a nuclear weapon in space. And obviously you can understand a lot of reasons why you would not want to do that. But he seems to think right now, you know, if push came to shove and we heard later today on the Central Time, you know, news break at 4 o'clock that, hey, we've got an incoming asteroid, he thinks researchers could rally if, you know, politicians gave them the license to do so.
Knocking on wood to not be jinxed there on that headline.
Yeah, right?
Well, do we know some of those hard questions, the answers to them about what a nuclear blast would do, how it would behave in outer space, and also would there be potential, you know, fallout, literally, I guess, and symbolically,
yeah,
on here on planet Earth?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is he has done just about all the experimentation he can do on the planet. In fact, he took all his research to a place called the Z Machine, which I just love the sound of. And we've got a photo, yeah, in the magazine of this crazy thing. It's in New Mexico, and it's the world's most powerful nuclear blast simulator. And they use it for all different kinds of research. But he went there, he took a bunch of different kinds of small, very small meteorites with him, and tested kind of how much force would be needed, the distance, the, you know, everything based on how big the asteroid was, what it was composed of, etc. And so he's worked out a lot of that, as much as he can do on the ground, but he really wants to try some tests in space. And that's where he's, you know, coming into some obstacles, people saying, I don't think that's such a good idea. But his argument is, if we could identify the asteroid far enough out, we could detonate the weapon so that there would be no potential for harm to the planet.
Well, that's going to be one to watch out for. Now, I know, Gemma, you are a fan of figuring out the earliest human origins, the origins of civilization, and you're just kicking off a series in Discover called Origin Story. You start us off with funeral practices in ancient Egypt. So what is the newest high-tech stuff telling us about ancient Egypt?
Yeah, and actually, just to back up a little bit, Origin Story is our new column. And the whole idea of it is to explain where we as 21st century humans came from. So some months we're going to delve into culturally where are our roots. Sometimes it'll be looking at evolution and the earliest hominids. And sometimes it'll be a mix of both. We're kind of taking the broad look at how we came to be who we are. And we started Origin Story in March with a story about, you know, ancient Egypt is the world's first formal state, the world's first formal political state. And we know that, but we're really fuzzy on what came before it. And basically prevailing theory was, oh, it was just a bunch of hunter-gatherers, and they were kind of all sprinkled all over Egypt and Sudan, and then, poof, they became a political state. And there's been a lot of questions. How did they do it? How quickly did they do it? Evidence suggested they did it very quickly, which was kind of mysterious. So fast forward to 2014, when this University of York chemical paleochemist, he actually is, I did not know that was a thing, but it's a thing, he's a paleochemist, and he analyzed funerary textiles from a location in Egypt that was really incredibly old. The textiles were more than 3,000 years old. Some of them were almost 4,500 years old. He was able to identify in the actual textiles the residue of what they used to mummify the individuals. So not only were they mummifying the individuals, which he proved because there was a question about how early mummification started, but he found out the recipe for mummifying these individuals, you know, 4,500 years ago was the same recipe, just about, that they were using 3,000 years later at the height of mummification in the Egyptian state. And this points to Neolithic Egypt, pre-dynastic Egypt, being way more advanced and way more a cohesive society than we ever thought possible. And it's really exciting that these tiny little fragments are just completely rewriting our understanding of ancient Egypt's chronology.
Right, so does this mean that this group of hunter-gatherers were a lot more organized and advanced than we thought, and it changes the actual timeline about ancient Egyptian society and how it formed?
Yes, it does, absolutely, because, you know, they had the same recipe down, the same recipe that was used throughout Egypt, throughout the entire existence of the state. And they had that down, nailed down, 4,500 years ago. And some of the ingredients came as far away as Turkey. So that tells you they were trading for specific ingredients. They had the procedure down because some ingredients had to be heated or processed. They had the proportion of ingredients down. So they nailed it all down, which tells you they were performing empirical science that long ago, you know, more than 6,000 years ago. And at the same time, it implies that in addition to them being advanced, they were also a cohesive culture already. So whether you live kind of in the Nile Valley or out kind of in the, you know, grazing lands hundreds of miles away, you seem to share the same culture. And that's really exciting news.
Well, Gemma, interesting stuff. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing it with us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about the latest science news. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. That's the theme music from The Great Escape, one of my all-time favorite war movies. The success of American Sniper over the last month has gotten a lot of attention, both in terms of box office numbers and in generating a political discussion about the meaning of the movie and what it says about the nation's most recent wars.
But how does American Sniper fit into the history of war movies? Our next guest says the genre has gone through a lot of changes over the last century, and he joins us now to share some of the history and some of his recommendations for great war films.
Mike Mayo is a movie writer. His recent books include The Horror Show Movie Guide and the novel Jimmy the Stick, and a new sequel, Everybody Goes to Jimmy's. He's also the author of Video Hound's War Movies, Classic Conflict on Film. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me. This is a really interesting subject to talk about.
Definitely. Well, let's start with a look at this new, well, newish now movie, American Sniper. It was number one for some weeks there. Surprisingly, big sales at the box office. Here's a clip with Bradley Cooper in the lead role.
Would you be surprised if I told you that the Navy has credited you with over 160 kills?
Mm.
Do you ever think that you might have seen things or done some things over there that you wish you hadn't?
Oh, that's not me, no.
What's not you?
I was just protecting my guys. They were trying to kill our soldiers, and I'm willing to meet my creator and answer for every shot that I took. The thing that haunts me are all the guys that I couldn't save. I'm willing and able to be there, but I'm not. I'm here. I quit.
Mike, you picked American Sniper as one of your best movies of 2014. Came out late, actually, in the year. What do you like about the movie?
Let me say first that I saw this kind of before all of the controversy started. I saw an advanced screener of it, and so I went into it completely cold, just thinking of this as a war movie, as a Clint Eastwood movie, and I was completely shocked by it. I just thought it was his he did for the war movie with this movie what he did for the Western with Unforgiven, and that it's a very serious look at a complicated subject. It doesn't really take any kind of political stand. It's not really trying to change what you think about either war movies or Westerns, but to make you think more deeply about them. Since then, I've seen it a second time, and I've come to believe that even more strongly. And I think it's a very this is something that I haven't heard anyone else say. I think it's a very personal movie for Eastwood, because in a lot of ways, this is a movie about men and guns. That's certainly what Chris Kyle's career was about. And when you think about it, that is what Clint Eastwood's career has been about. Almost every movie that he's made that features firearms of one kind or another. And that was really reinforced to me the second time I watched it and watched into the credits and realized that the film ends with a funeral and a really kind of haunting trumpet dirge. I'm not sure what you would call it. And then I saw in the closing credits that that was written by Ennio Morricone. Morricone, you will remember, was the guy that did all the music for the spaghetti westerns that actually launched Clint Eastwood's career with Sergio Leone. So there was kind of a, you know, circling back to his beginnings with that. To me, that gave the whole movie a resonance that I hadn't seen before, and I'm kind of surprised at the controversy, and I'm very happy to see that it's doing so well, because I had a feeling it was too serious a film really to be a hit during the holiday season, and I'm glad to be proved wrong on that, because I'm glad a lot of people are seeing it.
You know, there has been controversy, people saying it valorizes war, some people saying, no, this is a good patriotic thing, all points in between. We'll maybe hear from some of our callers on that. Want to start getting into movie history, though. Does American Sniper leap for you into the list of classic war movies?
I think it does, and I would put it up there with Saving Private Ryan, in that it's trying to take a more personal look at what the effect of war on individuals. I disagree with the political arguments about this film. I think it is about what this one man experienced in the war, and it tries to we can argue the rightness or wrongness of the war in a different context. This is about what he did, how it affected him, how it affected his family, and I think those are things that we see very seldom in war movies. We tend to either, you know, glamorize it, the people who fought it, or to just overemphasize the brutality of it, but both of which are legitimate things to do in their own way. But we seldom look at what happens after it. And in that regard, I'm not going to say it's right up there with The Best Years of Our Lives, which is from 1946, which is absolutely the very best, I think, movie of that kind ever made. But I think it's trying to do some of the same things, and that's very important.
We'll get into a couple of the movies you just mentioned in a little more detail. But broad strokes, is that what makes a good war movie for you, the impact of the war on the individual who's in the middle of it?
Yes, and the other thing that a war movie has to do, it has to give me some idea about what it's like to be that guy who is there in the middle of it. I know I can't fully experience what he did, but if I can get some idea of the emotional response that he had to the things that happened around him, that makes it a successful war movie. If I think a film has done that realistically, I generally tend to like it very much.
Well, let's get into the history a little. You had mentioned to me when I was chatting with you about this idea that you saw a big change coming into World War II in how we did war movies and how the heroes are presented.
Yeah, and before, if you look at the movies that Hollywood made about World War One, right up until World War II, they are about reluctant heroes who are kind of dragged into the fight. They don't want to be there. Thinking of films like Sergeant York. But then once World War II starts, it is really about how you then take these guys and form them into a unit. And the traditional Hollywood propaganda film that was started making in the 40s, you know, right after the war began, all feature a disparate group of guys, you know, different ethnic backgrounds, different geographical backgrounds, and they come together and form a fighting unit. Some of them don't make it, some do, usually. And that's the standard war movie that Hollywood made. After the war, we tended to get, in the 50s, more realistic things, like Battleground, an excellent example about the Battle of the Bulge. And then we tended to get into more of the escapist things in the 60s after that, the Guns of Navarone, the Dirty Dozen, things like that really treat the war as just a great adventure.
Well, here's a clip from Battleground, which you just mentioned. It actually came out shortly after the war, centered on the Battle of the Bulge in World War II. In this scene, a chaplain is stopping by for a little sermon on the big question, is the sacrifice worth it?
So my answer to the $64 question is, yes, this trip was necessary. As the years go by, a lot of people are going to forget, but you won't. And don't ever let anybody tell you you were a sucker to fight in the war against fascism. And now, Jerry permitting, let us pray.
So the movie, that's just one bit of the message behind it there. But a lot of it is, as you say, this unit coming together. Some of them make it, some of them don't. It's not a heroic romp by any means.
No. And that is an excellent example of a movie that tells you the entire story from the point of view of this one platoon, these guys who are together. They never know what they're doing. I mean, they're told to dig foxholes in one place, then to go and move somewhere else, to put stripes on their shoulders and then take them off. They have no idea where the Germans are, even where they are. They don't understand any of that. And you never get any bigger picture than that. you as a viewer are right there with them. You have the same confusion and the same knowledge and lack of knowledge that they have. And to me, that's what makes it one of the greats. And if people are not familiar with it, because it is an older movie, this is one to seek out. It is really one of the all-time great war films.
Another one on your list, and you mentioned it a few moments ago, The Best Years of Our Lives. This is mostly, as I understand it, about troops after the war. I'm going to play a scene of what we would now probably call PTSD, a soldier airman, I think, waking up from a dream.
Hey, you guys, jump! Get out of there, bail out! Gnoski! Gnoski, get out of that plane!
Toot yourself, one. Three. Come on, the rest of you guys.
Fred.
Come on, get out!
Fred, wake up!
Gnoski!
Wake up!
Gnoski! She's burning up! Get out!
Fred.
Get out!
Fred, wake up! Wake up!
She's burning up! She's gonna hit! Look out!
It's all right, Fred. Go back to sleep.
So I had not seen that movie, that scene. There's also a scene of a soldier arriving at home without his hands anymore. You know, these are stories we think of, we hear a lot in the Vietnam, post-Vietnam era, and PTSD with our more recent wars. This is a movie telling those stories after World War II.
Yeah, and it did just an absolutely wonderful job of it. I mean, it's... To my mind, it is William Wyler's best film, and he was, I think, the best American filmmaker ever. That movie, you can watch it over and over again and find something new every time, because it's a big, complicated movie that's telling several stories. None of them come to a kind of an unambiguous happy ending. The movie begins unfinished and ends unfinished, and I think that's quite proper. It's still quite satisfying dramatically, but you really feel like you've just spent a little time with these guys in their lives, and their wives and their children. I would gush on about this movie for an hour if you would let me. Go see that. Put that on your list and get a hold of a copy of it this weekend.
And one of the biggest names on your list, this is one from the 50s now, From Here to Eternity. Now, that a lot of that isn't the war stuff. It's the soldiers and their personal lives, too. Why is that on your list?
Because that was, of course, based on the famous James Jones novel. And he, in some ways, this is a very autobiographical film for him. He was there in Pearl Harbor on December 7th when the attack came. And so even though there's, you know, this great melodramatic story going on, they really get all the details of it right. And that film just looks so good, so crisp. Really, with all three of these, some of the finest black and white cinematography you will ever see. Terrific acting, really well-written roles. In From Here to Eternity, Montgomery Clift and Burt Lancaster lead a really great ensemble cast. And that is another one that, if you haven't seen it in a while, and if you've never seen it, find it right away, that is just so enjoyable, such a terrific movie, stands up to repeated viewings very well, and I think just nails the experience of being a soldier in peacetime better than virtually anything else that I've ever seen.
We're talking to film writer Mike Mayo about war movies in light of the recent box office success of American Sniper.
And you can join the conversation. Did you go to see American Sniper? What did you think? Do you watch war movies in general? And do you have a favorite war movie of all time? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Mike Mayo now. He's a movie critic and author of the Video Hound book on war movies. We're talking about the history of war films in light of the success of the movie American Sniper.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen American Sniper? Good war movie. What are your thoughts on that? Do you have a favorite war movie of all the time? Do you like war movies or do you avoid the genre? Tell us why. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to Donald calling from outside Milwaukee. Donald, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I love war movies. I just love the genre altogether. I think that from Here to Eternity and The Best Years of Our Lives are two of the greatest war movies that were ever made. But I'd like to get your opinion on a movie that was made pretty good time ago, All Quiet on the Western Front, starring Lou Ayres, and it kind of delves into the horrors of war, and it gets into the personal lives of the individuals involved. And also, born on the 4th of July. I'd like to hear your comment about that movie.
Donald, I'm going to jump in. You're giving us a lot to talk about here, Mike. First of all Quiet on the Western Front, a World War One movie.
Yeah, that's one of the first really great serious war movies. It's about World War One. It's told from the point of view of a German. It follows a German soldier. It is very much an anti-war film, very strong with that, and really shocking. The violence that is depicted there is stunning for its time. Born on the 4th of July, I think, is another really good film. It's always in danger of being a little too preachy and coming on too strong, but I think the really good performance by Tom Cruise in that is what keeps it from becoming that. And again, I think both of those are excellent and well worth a second viewing.
Do we hit a point around the Vietnam era where more of our war movies were anti-war movies?
Yes, and there, you kind of see right after Vietnam, it was such an unpopular war that they essentially made no movies about it for several years. It wasn't until the relative success of Apocalypse Now that we started to see more. And I guess actually The Deer Hunter may have come out right at the same time. I can't remember which of those was first. And The Deer Hunter, when you look at it again, you realize it's really about a country making peace with itself. It's less about the war than what the war did to America and how it affected, again, the men who fought it and the people that they left back home.
Get back to our callers now. Brian is with us in Fond du Lac. Brian, hi.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I've been really fascinated about the idea of literature being more general in the psychological aspect of the human condition. But movies reflecting the psychology of an era cultural psychology of an era. I was talking about Apocalypse Now with the person screening the calls, and one of the things I saw, I don't know if I call it a psychological movie or a psychiatric movie, coming from the business of the post-Vietnam residue, for want of a better word.
Interesting. Brian, thanks for the call. Mike, Apocalypse Now as the psychology of the era for the country as much as the individual soldiers.
Yeah, and think back to those opening scenes of Apocalypse Now. After we've had those incredibly impressive shots of the helicopters over the jungle, we cut to Martin Sheen in this hotel room, literally going crazy. Mm-hmm. And that's a movie that kind of starts from a point of relative sanity and just gets more and more insane as it goes along. It's a fever dream of a movie. Again, one of my favorites, and just let me mention that that's a movie that now exists in two different versions. There's the theatrical version that came out, and then a longer version with several extra scenes came out on DVD a few years ago. And for those like me who really like that movie, don't watch the long version. There's enough in Apocalypse Now as it exists in the first version that we don't really need that other stuff. And it just gets in the way and I think dilutes a really powerful film.
Brian, thanks for the call. We'll go to Gary in South Milwaukee now. Gary, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us?
Well, Apocalypse Now was one of them. Saving Private Ryan. This American Sniper is a great movie. And Platoon. On the stage, John Wayne, how can you not say hi to him? But the genre is good, and they just seem to be getting more realistic, so it really puts people, you know, in a different audience level than it used to be years ago.
Gary, why do you like this genre in particular?
I'm a veteran. I mean, I was in the Army, and I don't know. I've always liked it, even when I was a kid watching, you know, movies way back when, the World War II in Korea and stuff like that. So I just like it, you know. I think it's good entertainment, and I just wish that more politicians would watch them and pay attention, and maybe they wouldn't vote for all these wars all the time.
Interesting perspective, Gary. Thanks a lot for that call. So, a vet there appreciates the war movies, especially when they're realistic, it sounds like, to tell us, you know, inform our decision-making here, Mike.
Exactly. And that, I think that is one of the reasons, I think Gary hits on a reason that war movies continue to be so popular, because just the entire setting provides a legitimate way for Hollywood to deal with the things that Hollywood does best: violent confrontations, these, you know, kind of epic battles between forces. They can do that very well on a big movie screen. And when you're dealing with that in the context of a serious war movie, it's not just escapism. It's not just bombs blowing up and guys shooting each other. There's a reason for it and a larger context there. That's why I think war movies will always be popular, even though in individual times they will not be popular depending on what the nation feels about the most recent conflict.
Yeah, Mike, briefly as we wrap up, seems like war movies haven't been that big lately. Now here's this huge hit, American Sniper. Do you think we're going to see more? Maybe looking more at our more recent wars?
Possibly, but it is so difficult to make a good movie like this. We had a very similar movie last year, Lone Survivor, Soul Survivor, I'm not sure the proper title. Very similar to American Sniper in a lot of ways. It just didn't catch on with the public. So it's really, from a Hollywood point of view, is this going to be a good, profitable movie? It's difficult to say. And it's so difficult in Hollywood these days to get any kind of serious movie made. You've got to have a filmmaker with the clout of a Clint Eastwood, I think, really even to get the producers to think about making that kind of movie now.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us as always.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's Mike Mayo. He's a movie writer. He has written books including Video Hounds, War Movies, Classic Conflict on Film. If you missed it, I did. The Grammy Awards were last night.
One big winner of the night was Sam Smith for his emo ballad, kind of gospelish song. You've definitely heard it. It's called Stay With Me. Smith won Best New Artist, Vocal Album of the Year, Record of the Year, and if that's not enough, Song of the Year.
Losers kind of included Kanye West, who, according to our friend, the internet, had to restrain himself from busting in when his pal Beyonce lost out to Beck for Album of the Year. That story prompted our youngest producer to ask the question, who's back?
Well, the nice thing about the internet is you don't actually have to watch the Grammy Awards to know what happened at the Grammy Awards.
Right. You can go back and catch the highlights the next day. I don't know. I've gotten more into award shows lately. I don't know why I didn't tune into the Grammys last night. It just wasn't on my radar for some reason.
Right. Well, you know what happened anyway. It's probably archived somewhere. And we're going to go out to the news with a song that everyone likes a lot, at least last night at the Grammys. Sam Smith with his song Stay With Me. And you can stay with us here on Central Time.